So welcome to Nostalgia Pilots, a Gundam Wing fan cast that has guided your children to a very cruel destiny. I'm your host, Hugh.
I'm Jared.
I'm Jason.
I'm Spence.
And we're here to discuss Gundam Wing episode 41, Crossfire at Barge.
First of all, new intro, not my real dad. I can't get into it.
Also, I love the new intro.
Also, but was it really a barge, though?
No, barge is just the name of their super fortress.
But you can't call the super fortress a barge.
Hold on. We need to discuss this because I'm totally split on the intro. I really like the new animation action, although it looks like it's mostly just cut from various aspects of the show. Mm-hmm. The song, though, I don't know.
Well, so, like, the thing that gets me into the show is where it goes, just wild beat communication. And I didn't have that anymore. And I was saddened. And then immediately my next reaction was, you're not my real dad.
Now this intro, this is why
EM Revolution is not my real dad.
This is White Reflection, right?
Yeah.
No, it's Rhythm of Motion.
Oh, right.
See, White Reflection is a much better song than Rhythm.
It is. They're saving the good one for the movie.
Yeah.
I had the same issue with Attack on Titan. The first theme song they use is much better than what happens in the second half of the season.
That theme song is epic. Like, that theme song will get you to fight people. Like, that theme song is fantastic. You want to fight giant monsters? That's the song to come into.
And this show, this episode delivers fighting in spades, actually. We got some pretty sweet space combat off the start.
Yeah, no, it's actually a Gundam fighting Gundam show this time.
Like, we had a lot of Gundams fighting a lot of things this episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, lots of space lasers. Lots of space lasers.
The one bit I really do like in the new opening, though, is there's this shot of Relina and Hiro standing together, and Relina is in her fancy white coat.
Mm-hmm.
And Hiro has the same coat, but it's black.
Yeah, I like that dichotomy, even though I don't think we've ever actually seen Hiro in
That is not Hiro's coat. Hiro only wears that in that one still shot.
Is that the most
90s opening thing ever.
No, he stole Trace's coat just for a photo shoot, for propaganda, you know.
Trace's coat is blue.
It's like in Solo when they found Billy Dee Williams' cape coat. Closet. When they found his closet of cape coats.
I thought it was interesting that they had sound effects blended with the music. That's also what took me out of the intro a bit, because normally with the intro you don't hear the sound effects underneath it, you just hear the music and see the sound effects. It did kick me back
a little bit to the 90s when you would we were still in that phase where you would record things off of other things, where you would get that sort mm-hmm. of lead over, like the weird radio DJ at the start of your songs, or just that ridiculous, like if you wanted to grab something from an anime. I recall very distinctly having a track from Akira that was like all full of the audio artifacts from the actual movie.
Oh yeah, like I remember I had a Talkboy, and so I used it to record episodes of Sailor Moon off television, and the final fight against Queen Beryl, where Serena finally achieves her Moon Princess form, and then the spirits of all the fallen Sailor Scouts come and help her out. There's this really awesome song playing that's going on, and I wanted to record that. And the whole time, you're still getting the sound effects of the fight. And I'm like, it's still good.
Side note, I actually cried at that scene, and I did not think that Sailor Moon would make me cry.
It's a very emotional scene, because one thing I'll give that show is that they build up a lot of character development and bonding between all of them. So having all of them sacrifice themselves just to get her there, and then she almost loses, it's fantastic.
Yeah. Good stuff. Anyway. So
then they all forget she exists.
Because there are moon beams out of a cat's forehead.
Well, because they didn't know quite what to do for season two.
Yeah. But the band is back together.
Yes.
Yeah.
So should we call the band? Should we call this Crossfire Barge, or should we call this Reunion at Barge? Because I feel like everyone on the planet came back.
Except for, not at the barge itself, but like everybody who's still alive showed up.
Yes.
Except Wu Fei. Wu Fei can't be bothered to show up to the biggest fight in the
since the show, like in the show's like, inception.
Well, because yeah, it's like, mainstream even
though,
now.
Even though his whole thing is he shows up when people are fighting in space and kills everybody.
He didn't show up to kill everybody.
Like I bet he shows up like 5 minutes late and is like, oh,
he's like, damn it.
Just damn it.
Like they're all getting back on this ship. They're like, wait, what's that? What's that in the distance? And he's like, I'm coming, guys. And it's like he just trunches up. All right, where's the fight? And they're like, dude, it's over. Like
okay. But the scene where Noin does get everybody, like, she's got to go off. She's going to intercept Zek. She's going to have a discussion with him about why he's attacking or why he's behaving the way he is. And then it just becomes this train of, like, Catra, who, okay, it's within his character that he's, like,
going to be concerned about her.
Yeah, exactly. So he's like, oh, you got to take me along. And then Duo, who up until this point has been like, I'm not murdering anyone anymore. You know what? Actually, I better remind everybody that I'm a murder machine. So I'm just going to come.
I like to check in. I like the way he introduces himself into this conversation.
The God of Death.
He literally just peeks over the edge of something and goes, "The God of Death is back." Like you're like, wait a minute.
And then they just do the camera pan back where he like Duo turns around. He's like, "Are you in too?" And Tro's like, "Meh, shrug. Yep, let's go murder some folks." Okay.
So this scene bothers me. And the reason being is that, you know, we've got Noin floating in zero G. We've got Catra floating in zero G. We've got Duo's hair floating in zero G. If Noin was wearing her fringe shirt, her fringe would be floating in zero G.
If they could pay for the animation.
If they could pay for the animation. And then Troa is just like, nope, I'm standing flat on this.
Yeah, he's just like, no, I have gravity. You don't have gravity. I have gravity. I don't remember what non-gravity is.
Like, and later on, when he's fighting in his when the mobile's in the TARDIS, he also defies the laws of Newton. Like, he literally starts, like, somehow he breaks in space with no jets. Like,
yeah.
Well, this whole episode closes on a shot of the four of them drifting in exact unison in one direction in space. Like,
yeah, it's weird. And it bothered me. It bothered me enough that I wrote it down.
Newton is rolling over in his grave. He's dying right now.
The first thing I want to talk about that we kind of skipped is we had lazy Lady Oz soldiers this episode.
We did.
I am
and
not
that was weird.
I am not happy with this. With you talking about the lady with the countdown?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a female bridge commander on barge, and there was also a female bridge commander on Sidichi's shuttle.
Mm-hmm. One of those should have been Lady Un. One of them should have been Lady Un.
Well, Lady Un is still dead as far as we know.
Well, I know
as a use of her character, though, I agree that this would have been a really good place to slaughter in. There's another character coming up. I don't want to get ahead on your notes here, Hugh, but there's another character, like the reappearance of Sally Poe in this episode.
Yeah. I think Lady Un couldn't be in this scene because then they wouldn't have this nameless commander who effed up so badly.
Well, also she wouldn't have hesitated to push the giant space laser button. Like,
well, no, but she wouldn't have missed.
Yeah, like he paused and like was like gave Zex the opportunity, but she would have murdered billions. She would have shot that satellite's out of the sky.
She would have just been like, I wouldn't have grazed that satellite. I would have had a dead center shot.
But the tension of that scene where if they had swapped out Mustache Guy for Lady Un, that character arc would have made so much more sense and her death would have been a little more relevant other than her lame just sort of shot in an airlock.
Yeah, it would have actually given her some gravitas. Like, you know, say she took Trace's ideals too far. And Zex being Trace's ex-boyfriend had to put her down, you know?
And like, that would have given the whole thing in this episode where they are tense about the fact that the barge cannon is almost grazing the colony. Like, that would have been what Lady Un would have done. She would have just fired civilians be damned, and that would have... Anyway, I don't want to get too far on a theoretical character arc, but...
It would have been
fantastic. I think we're going to revisit this next episode. I'm not going to say why, but...
Uh-oh.
Next episode.
So they keep talking about this new laser in the barge, and it's like kind of Death Starry. And
did anybody get Hal from this? Because I definitely was thinking of Space Odyssey when I saw the giant red like
circle. Well, it is like a giant circle with a big red eye in the middle of it.
I mostly got Death Star vibes off of it, and they were talking about how it could possibly overload the system, and I was like, oh, so they're going to try to fire it too frequently, and then it's going to implode on itself.
Well, they've souped up the barge cannon, which we've seen before, but it wasn't red, so... new barge laser. But they also gave all their Tauruses, like, welding lasers.
Because they made it sound like they never had laser guns in the past. And I'm like, well, they didn't have projectiles. Well, so
the thing is that they got different laser guns, because those are laser guns that can get through the Virgo shields. Like the Star Trek shields that all of the other mobile dolls have.
I want to
photon torpedo kind of things.
Pretty much.
Yeah, I want to say that they I don't think they mentioned it, but I think that's what they were hinting at. Remember when we saw in the hangar all the new mobile suits getting the new paint jobs?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think, because you see later on, you actually see some of the shielded mobile dolls with a different paint job. So I'm thinking that's what they were kind of hinting at, like these new models could stand up to those shields and such and such. I think that's what they were getting at when we were, because we were both like, we were all like, why don't we get to see these things in action? And I think this is the episode where we get to see them in action a little bit.
Although it does underline a little bit the constant space combat, the... I don't want to say silliness, because that's not right. Because aesthetically, it's really interesting on the screen. It's interesting visually. But having bipedal robots in space, especially when they can be put in hammer locks, as happens later in the episode.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I thought was weird from a military standpoint is that the people on the barge, they were doing a countdown to impact. I'm like, okay, but you have fighters. Why not?
Well, they pretty much...
Why not plan an offensive, you know, to protect your interests? Why are you waiting for them to come and impact you?
Because even though they're in space, they're still fighting like they're Napoleonic armies. And so they had all of their space robots line up and then count down to when they were in firing range.
It again, doesn't make sense. But okay, I'm going with it. And then I did like that the White Fang control center had a very video game-esque console setup. And I'm like, oh, look, it's that scene from Guardians of the Galaxy where all of the different golden people were fighting using remote controlled units.
Pretty much.
And I was like, that's great. How many quarters did they use?
A lot, because the Gundam pilots are murder machines.
It's true. Okay.
Speaking of murder machines.
Definitely a murder machine.
There's also murder, not just in space, but also down below on Earth, where Hero is conducting his own personal war.
He's Rambo. He's the Gundam version of Rambo.
He's fighting a bunch of Leo. So are these the people that he like saved last episode?
I think so. They crossed him and he had to murder them.
Well, no, they didn't cross him. They just have a spaceship.
But Sally shows up, which was fantastic. Excellent to see her suddenly arrive.
Yeah,
and she does have to have a continued dialogue about, okay, listen, Hero. Don't shoot me. We have to have a conversation.
So I think this is a callback way back when Hero blew up or cut that one shuttle in half, and he went off half cocked and killed that shuttle, and then like murdered that dude.
So she's like laying a burn on him. Like, listen, yeah, I know you just shoot every friggin' shuttle you see flying around, but this time I'm here to help.
Yeah, I really do. I think it is, because if you look at him, like he has the look in his eyes of having the Zero system going, but somehow she doesn't open a line of communication. Like she doesn't contact his.
No, she just shoots a laser pointer in his eye.
She was signaling him with the laser.
So wait, is he a cat?
Yeah.
No, she was doing Morse code. She was like turning it on and off again.
Yeah, like I do my cats when I want to play.
That's kind of what I was thinking too. It's like, ooh, look at the shiny thing. Don't attack me. Look at the shiny thing.
What would be really great if Hiro started batting at the sky? Like, you're like, ah, something in my eye.
Speaking of the shiny thing, she's bought some equipment secondhand from the local circus.
Seriously. Oh,
she does not say where she gets it.
I laughed out loud.
What's her name? Catherine? Catherine was like, man, I am not dealing with his junk anymore. I've already thrown the rest of his crap to the curb. So what am I going to do with this friggin' thing? And then
she gets a lot of money for the Gundam from Sally Poe's little army and buys herself a little condo.
Yeah, I imagine Sally Poe's been watching Craigslist for a Gundam for weeks at this point, just waiting for a listing to pop up.
And the worst part is, like, I was watching this, and what made me laugh so loud, I was like, this is going to be the heavy arms. And it's going to be still on that flatbed truck wrapped in that thing. And sure enough, there it goes, coming right off the back of that shuttle, wrapped in the cloak on the flatbed. I'm like, come on, animators. Like,
I knew it was going to go that way, but I did kind of hope that we'd get a shot at some point of them just using the heavy arms, like, at the circus for really mundane circusy, like, just giving children rides or, like, you can take a picture in the Gundam.
Using the rotating barrels to lift things like a crank.
Hooking a space Ferris wheel up to it so they can replace Catra's got a vendetta against. Anyway.
The thing that happened is I think they wrote themselves into a corner where they're like, oh, we need to bring the Troa's Gundam back, but Troa doesn't remember where it is because we can't cure his amnesia yet.
Yep.
So they're just like, Sally has it. I don't know.
So yeah. One thing I did like about this scene is that unlike previous scenes where they've just whipped off the top, they did actually show a guy taking off the tie down straps to unwrap it. So it was I noticed it and I was appreciative of it.
It was a nice little bit of animation and it was very dramatic, which was nice.
Even though we all knew what was under
there. Yeah, even though it was like, well, there's one suit it can be.
If there was anything surprising about that scene, it was actually Sally delivering the line, I know for a fact that Gundam pilots can be trusted, because she clearly has not watched the rest of the series. What is she talking about?
I mean, her experience with Wu Fei might have colored her judgment. Because
after a muttering about space madness.
Well, to be fair, he did like prevent the whole east or west coast from being irradiated.
Yes, but he also destroyed a space Ferris wheel. He did. He did destroy the space Ferris
wheel. She wasn't in space. She doesn't know about that.
Yeah, that's fine. I don't think she's ever left Earth, has she?
Nope. No, she has not.
Yeah, so
also curiously, even though we do get some great time in the Romerfeller Foundation. No Dorothy this episode.
There was a tiny bit of Dorothy this
episode.
There
is a tiny bit of Dorothy, and I do want to talk about it because she is a stalker. And she's like, huh, Relina's leaving. Well, we should talk about why Relina's leaving, though.
Okay, so this is where things get weird, because we switch to the Romerfeller High Council or whoever they are. And they're feeling bad about making Relina have to fight a war, even though she's a pacifist.
But it's against her brother, and that's even worse.
And then Trace shows up with like a whole bunch of dudes with semi-automatic machine guns.
Trace doesn't just show up. Trace finishes the dude's sentence with like, oh, well, I'm glad you feel that way, from outside the room. He's clearly had his ear to the door the entire time, waiting for the right moment to deliver his line, and then he storms in.
One of his goons had a glass that he just tucked into his satchel and then grabbed his rifle.
But my thing is like this. That's exactly how you want Trace to enter, because he needs the perfect timing. Like, he needs the perfect timing. And the best part is that they show, like, he says the line, but they still don't show him. And then they just slowly shoot him from the floor up. And the first thing you see are boots and cape coat. Like, it's he has a fabulous introduction.
Yeah, like.
He's so pompous this episode. Like, he is such an arrogant bastard in this episode, and it's fantastic.
Like, this is the episode where Trace is like really that dramatic bitch.
Oh, he
he's
is.
Like this he's whole had thing. His training montage, and now he's like, I'm a champ.
Yeah,
you know, he hung out in his robot basement
in the dark with his mom upstairs making cookies.
And now he's cleaned himself up. He's ready to for his comeback.
Yeah, him and
ready to fire Relina.
Him and his buddies.
Yeah, and this is the thing. Like, not only does he like have like take these guys hostage and say, "Well, you should make," like he very politely says, "Well, what you could do is you could help me to become president of Earth, and I could solve this problem for you."
No, he doesn't want to be king of Earth. He wants to be the chief representative.
Yes, and which I love is how Relina's title. So he's going to be queen of Earth.
And I love how, yeah, I love how they answer this question by him saying, "I'll just happen to ask you to resign as queen." And like, wait, so you're gonna,
but
you're gonna fill in as queen?
But before we get there, we cut to Relina, who is glaring at what I think is supposed to be the sunset.
It's so weird. It looks like
purple. Everything got purple.
Everything got red and on my screen. And
Auburn.
And
it's red, but the highlight behind it is like this weird, like bluish purple.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't look like a real sunset. Like this whole thing looks like
she would be in outer space in an artificial structure, and there's a planet right there that's being cut off by some structure.
Is lit like it's a dream sequence.
Yeah.
And Relina gets tired of glaring at things in her room alone. So she starts wandering the palace and can't find everyone, and everything is dark. And then she finally gets to, like, the council chamber, and it's empty, and then she spots Trayz with his back to her at the window.
Seriously, has she not watched a horror movie?
I also want to point out, though, that in this conversation that unfurls at that point, they're in the same room, but there's a few points, at least, in which they're in split screen. Like, yes, they couldn't even... Oh, my God.
She stays by the door and then like it's half on her, half on him. And he explains to her that he's going to have to ask her to resign.
It's the most dramatic.
He's always got to move. I've noticed this. He's always got to move, right? Like he's either feeding the bird or whatever. He finishes his statement. He basically fires the queen and then he opens the window and tells her about how free she is.
Yes.
He's having a tizzy right now. Like if the, like,
oh no, he is enjoying himself. He is the happiest he has ever been.
He's just like, I don't know what you call it. Like, it's not a tantrum. Like, I don't know. Is it like a flourish? Like an
he's in a fugue state of some kind.
But he's hearkening back to a time when he felt free to be himself. Yes. So I think he's only slightly talking about Relina, but talking about himself.
Do you think he's talking through Relina? Like, do you think like he didn't even realize Relina's queen? Like, do you think he's like he's just literally talking out loud? Like, he feels like Un is behind him taking notes. Like, he's just not even realizing Relina's there. Aww, like,
he knows Relina's there.
Is he missing his girl?
I think so.
I think he's missing his boy, because she's like, well, I have to talk down my brother and then I can stop being queen. And he just looks at her and is like, you can't.
You don't know him.
You can't do that.
She really doesn't know him, though.
No, she doesn't. Like, the only contact she's had with him since she was like a toddler was when she leaned out of an aircraft and yelled at him.
So what's funny about this, though, is that, okay, so she's fired. She immediately departs out the front door of the Romafeller Foundation or whatever.
Into her pink limo.
Yeah, Pagan is sitting there with the pink limo already running. Like, well, how long has he been? Okay. Just days
there,
and
there
days?
There has to have been some kind of time lapse, because she's back in, like, her civilian pencil skirt. Like, they did not let her keep queen dress or anything like that.
Well, the queen dress may not be comfortable to travel in. I mean, there's definitely a corset in there, and corsets are not comfortable to sit in a car in.
But she did not have luggage.
I feel Trayz would have told her to stuff in silence for her.
To be fair, though, Dorothy is overseeing this in full goth mode.
Yeah, she's still in her she's watching from her window, and
she doesn't have a line.
I have to go to space then, I guess.
She does. She says, well, Miss Relina, you're going to space. I guess I have to go too. And I'm like, why?
because she's obsessed with Relina and Hero. Like, she's
everything is happening in space.
She's angling that three-way, man. She's angling it. She's trying hard.
But my favorite part of this scene is, like, as Relina is walking to her car, she briefly looks backwards and, like, they turn off the exterior lights. Like, she must have been there with like a switch. Like, no, you're not coming back in.
Like, I picture the scene from that song, "Love Don't Live Here Anymore," and just flip the switch and just like, oh, now it's the crazy artificial moonlight. Okay.
No, I feel like Trace told one soldier, "Look, you have one job. You sit right here." She's going to look back. And when she looks back, you better turn that light off. If you don't turn that light off, I'm going to execute you. Like, so there's just one lone, like, private just sitting there, just waiting. Like, he's like, this is going to be my big moment. I'm going to get promoted. Like, he's just waiting, so excited. He has no weapon. He's just waiting. Like, it's like, and he sees her turn around and goes, this is my moment. This is it. And I just wish that it had played out that another person had run up and hit the light switch, like at the end of Not Another Teen Movie. And he steals the slow clap from him. It would have made my day.
So that's our act break. And then we come back.
And then we come back to the Death Star and how it misfired.
Yes. Angry.
Well, it kills a bunch of robots that don't have people in them.
Oh, yeah. But it also kills Sergeant Rockabilly, and I was sad to see him go.
Yep. Yep. So, Sadichi gets unceremoniously blown up.
Are you trying to say that Billy Ray Cyrus was blown up in this episode?
Well, the younger White Fang guy gets killed, because he's overseeing all the mobile dolls.
The guy who dresses like a greaser from Fallout.
Again, I think I've said this three episodes in a row. He should have had a name. Like, those guys from White Fang should have.
No, that guy has a name. His name was Sadichi.
Sadichi?
Yes.
So he was Italian?
Presumably.
Well, he kind of, if you look at the stereotype, he, like, that's what I'm saying. He's the guy with a white t-shirt and jeans and a rockabilly pompadour. Like, yeah, he's coming off the set of Grease. What do you want me to say?
Oh my god.
He gets blown up along with his lady who shouts stuff out to him.
So that's two that's two people in vehicles that have been blown apart to their deaths in two successive episodes.
But the problem is that the shot keeps going because lasers go through stuff and it like grazes a nearby colony.
And a bunch of people die.
And it makes... I don't know if anyone dies. It just kind of makes the
If it burst open a hole to space, there is the vacuum of space and people cannot survive that.
Okay.
We don't see favorite, that, though.
Some of my favorite part of that, though, is that, barge is firing and a bunch of the White Fang guys get destroyed. But Duo, Catra, Noin, and Troa have all arrived on the scene. And Tro immediately makes this snap decision that he's going to go hang out by the colony and protect the civilians. And everyone's like, what? And then he just takes off. But then they do fire. They basically clip the colony. And then Tro is like, you know what? I'm actually not going to hang out near the colony. This does not seem like the best place to be after all. And he immediately leaves. He's like, no, you know what? Actually, I'm good.
And you know what? Self-preservation took over at that point. Like, he was like, you know what? These people don't understand how lasers work. They're probably like, you know what? I'm just not going to be here right now. I don't have my Gundam, so I don't have my, you know, indestructible metal. So I'm just, you know what? I'm in the Taurus. Like, it's just, I'm not going to be here today. Like, I'm just,
yeah.
It's not right for me. I don't feel it. I'm not feeling it right now. I'm not feeling protecting you guys.
Did I say I was going to protect the colony? I don't remember. My memory is shot. You know how it is. Anyway.
Yeah. And space amnesia.
Yeah. So Zex is flying around, though, which is the whole point, right? Like, they're right there really to have a conversation with Zex. This whole thing with Barge and White Fang is almost a side. But then
they don't know that he's an Epion, because they still think that Hero has Epion.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and that's when they realize that it's not Hero.
When he swipes at them aimlessly. Like,
yeah.
It's like he's flailing that really slightly large or slightly phallic beam sword
at like them. The beam broadsword.
Yeah, because it's much wider than Heroes. Like, I feel like there's a lot of fallacy going between the two of them.
Yeah. When they say that Sandrock is ready for space, I was expecting something to be different. But like, nope. He's even still got the same metal blades. Everyone else is pulling out laser blades. He's like, guys, I'm going to cut some wheat.
So here's a little bit of my nerd boner about Gundam. So as a youth, I was like you. I was like, how come everybody has beam weapons and the Sandrock does not? So I looked it up. What it is his blades are special. They can actually heat up to ridiculous temperatures to melt through metal and Gundanium. That's what the thing about his two that his two big curved blades are. Albeit the same thing he did. Matter of fact, you can see it earlier when he throws them, they turn red, which indicates that they are now hot enough to melt through Gundanium and other metals. It's still stupid, and it still should be a beam weapon of some kind, but it at least makes them slightly unique.
There are moments in the show where, for example, it was something we've already discussed off the top, but when they're discussing how the mobile dolls can't handle the lasers, it'll overheat them and cause them to explode. Like, I feel like there's a technical background to the show that I don't necessarily get out of actually watching the show. Sometimes I feel like there's a little bit, like, almost, do you remember during the TNG era, they would put out, you know, like, the technical manual, the Star Trek technical manual. I feel like there's got to be additional materials around here somewhere where they explain, or they're working from a Bible that makes sense to them, but that I'm just not quite grasping.
Honestly, like, if you want to deep dive into Gundam in general, you can. You can. It's like, I would equate Gundam to what Warhammer 40K is. Like, if you decide to investigate space marines, you're going to be spending all day in the Black Library learning about all sorts of made up stuff. Same thing goes with the Gundams. Like, I mean, I did a little bit of research, like, because I wanted to know, like, what the chronology of the series were, and it got into like all kinds of stuff about how, like, this one Gundam series, I can't remember, I think, was it Turn A Gundam? I can't remember which one it was, that didn't finish. Like, it's the only Gundam series ever to not finish its actual
Gundam X, I think.
Yeah, and it's just, and
it was like the one after this series.
Yeah, and there's one also that has, like, where it's medieval times and space, because, like, the Gundams can turn into, like, dragons. Like, it just Yeah, and there's also which is the one that is Turn A Gundam, the one where they have the round Gundams where they're all bulbous kind of.
Where they were designed by like a European designer, so like they've got sort of different edges and
yeah,
and it is kind of steampunk because it's sort of like the far future and technology has reversed.
Yeah, it's like the Gundam, like. Gundam is so confusing because they've made, like we talked about earlier, they made Universal Century, mm-hmm. and then they made the other one, which I can't think of the name of. And
well, they made Fighting Century. Well, basically what happened is they did Universal Century for about 15 years, and then starting with G Gundam, they started doing like these alternate universe self-contained side stories. And then they went back and said, what if we had one that was the far future of all of these games, kind of like Breath of the Wild is the far future of all Zelda games, and that's Turn A Gundam. So yeah. There's like stuff from all of those series in Turn A Gundam, which makes it really confusing.
Yeah, and then they're like, oh, and also we're going to go back to Universal Century to continue the story of Amuro Ray
and then
pilots. Yeah.
And then we're going to do Gundam Unicorn, which is its thing.
Yeah, and just yeah, like the depths you can fall into about Gundam, and like the worst part is a lot of Gundam's lore and concepts are also based in reality, like because the creator of a certain Gundam was mad that they did this with another Gundam series. So he, in retaliation, would make another Gundam series, and then they would have to wedge them together. Like, Gundam, was it, is it, yeah, Gundam Reconquista in G.
Right. Which is Tomino coming back to do his own series about how it should have been.
Yeah. And it's just, it's a lot. Like, cause basically he got mad because he felt like they gave him a handler, basically. Like, he had people he worked with, and it turned out to be really good Gundam stuff. And so he got mad because he basically felt like they were limiting him in some way. So he comes back with Reconquista and G, which is just him by himself. And it's insane. Like, it is, it's bad.
But,
and
like, there were, like, three series between Gundam Seed and Iron Blooded Orphans that just America just didn't get, and that was one of them.
And there's also, like, in any Japanese fashion, there's novels and there's OVAs, there's a live action movie we won't talk about. And just
I still want to talk about that live action movie though.
Yeah, it's really the technical aspects though that I feel like sometimes there's an underlying detail to that I'm just not picking up. But
now that is one good thing about Gundam and most mech shows. Like, if you watch a mech show and it has interesting designs, it's almost always by the same guy. What's his name? Because he did one of the main Gundam designers for Gundam also did a show called Megazone 2-3, which was in three parts. It's an OAV series back in the 90s when anime had all kinds of money. And they could blow to make these one-off movies. And he basically made a triplet of films about human beings on a ship kept in a false reality because of things that happened on the planet Earth. Spoiler alert, the Wachowski siblings stole this concept to make The Matrix. Because they were the right age at the right time growing up to see this on TV in America when it came out. That was actually Megazone 3. Yeah, I've got it on DVD. I'll have to rip it and send it to you.
I think that it was a bit of a golden age for one-off movies or like triplets of movies or whatever, more due to the media release. Like, it was all VHS. It was all, I mean, at some period, DVD, which was, you know, no one could run a series of 100 episodes or...
Yeah, in the 90s, what happened was America heard about anime and was really interested, even though anime had been in America since the 80s, because like Akira got a release in theaters back in the 80s. Same with Orotsuka Doji, The Legend of the Overfiend, got a theatrical release here in the States. That's a straight up hentai where demon tentacle penises destroy a city.
We are getting way off track at this point.
But it is a quarter two, so...
Basically, when you look at Gundam and its totality, there's only three designers for all the Gundams, and they just bounce back and forth, and the creators all fight themselves because they're prima donnas about who can make the best giant robot show.
Which is actually kind of sad because I felt like Barge specifically could have used a little more design work. I felt like it was kind of a lazy design.
I mean, it was just HAL in space. I feel like they were trying to avoid the Death Star, but they just made the Death Star.
Pretty standard colony with just a laser shooting through it. Anyway, at this point,
who you're thinking of, Shinji Aramaki?
Yes, thank you.
Get in the robot, Shinji.
So at this point, they're outside of Barge. They're having a tussle. We've lost Sergeant Rockabilly. And they finally manage to encounter Zex. They realize it's not Hiro toting around. And Noin puts him in a hammerlock.
Yeah, well,
look Zex, she hugged him.
Kicks the crap out of Duo and Catra at the same time.
But Catra holds up better. Like, Catra holds him in the we're pinned. Look at the electrical sparks between our weapons. We're pinned right now. Duo just gets punked, and I'm very sad.
The thing with Duo is that like his moves like require him to like wind up and stuff. So he like winds up the big scythe and like loads both beams and then like
gets blocked.
Yeah, like
Epion, the problem is that they're both working with ranged weapons, whereas you know, Ketra is able to get in there in closer to get in under that range. Granted, Zex still has a sword, so he can defend against it, but he's using
like kung fu, like mobile suit kung fu, because he uses
maybe that's the advancements that they've made to Sandrock, so that he has better maneuverability in space, even if they don't change his weapons.
That is a feedback to when he was in space fighting in the Sandrock, and they were like, "You haven't been designed or adjusted for space." So you're right; it could be true, but. You know, they give the Death Scythe its own animation for when it does the big double-bladed scythe attack, because his eyes light up, they go green, he gets the streams coming off of it as he swings this thing, and he just gets blocked. And I'm like, come on, guys. Like, that's my favorite Gundam, guys. You're letting me down.
But yeah, so Noin interrupts this thing with a hug, and she's like, Zex, we need to talk. Don't you recognize me? And he's like, yeah. He's like, you know, and she says that, you know, your sister is making really good progress on Earth, and this was the plan, and now everything's going to plan. And he's just like, nope, I'm going to blow up Earth. Deal with it.
But first, let me go and chop up this barge, even though the other guys are trying to stop another...
So like the three of them are racing to barge to prevent it from firing again because it's in the middle of its countdown sequence.
Yeah.
But it's a different countdown sequence from the first time.
Right, because they had to recharge the energy beam.
Yes.
Yeah, and he gets there first somehow, even though in between
because he's that fast.
In between the time he gets hugged by Noin. Not only does the Death Scythe, the Sandrock, fight off a wave of enemies, but Troa shows up to block and defy the laws of physics
again,
and then he shows up to cut. Zex shows up, and honestly, guys, this boils down. This whole episode boils down to the fact that Zex just needed a hug.
Well, he got a hug and it didn't matter.
Yeah, he gave Barge quite the hug.
So here's my question. Because the boys were going to go and stop the laser, but they got this whole stricken no kind of face on when they see Zex cut the barge apart.
I was very confused about that.
I'm sitting here going, weren't they about to do the same thing? Because were they going to do different?
My presumption is that they were just going to disable the cannon.
Right, but how?
Whereas Zex just cut the whole station in half.
Look, guys.
Like he is Idris Elba in the second Thor movie.
Look, guys.
Heimdall.
This episode boils down to Zex needing a hug to get his sword up to cut this station in half.
Oh, like, my goodness.
Yeah, he did get that sword up.
But I have just facepalmed.
Look, it is the truth. Because up until after he gets the hug, his sword is normal size. But as soon after he gets the hug, it is enormous. Like, he cuts this thing in half because of the power of a hug. Just saying. Like, in all shonen anime across the board, there's a lot of things that motivate characters, but I've never seen a character until Zex be motivated to a phallic embrace to power his sword.
Never use the phrase phallic embrace again. Thank you.
And does that bring us to our favorite things from the episode?
Well, and then Barge blows up and
we have people.
Everyone is shocked and it plays sad music.
Oh, wait, they use the term barge is sinking, which I don't think is how space works.
Again,
well, you know.
Yeah, where is the gravity that it's sinking into?
It it's still in Earth orbit, so
I mean, yeah, I get, well, I just don't understand how, why it, now that it's cut in half, it's going down. If it's in orbit and it's cut in half, it's probably just going to be too heavy. Anyway, I don't know.
Well, I think they're just using the phrase, you know, sinking because it's a ship, when they should say exploding slowly.
or actually, technically, it should be, you can't technically explode in space because there's no oxygen, so it's just decompressing.
Yes.
I mean, to be fair. Like, I just,
they have laser swords.
When is any of this fair?
They don't have physics. It's fine. Again, Newton's.
Nothing that has laser swords also has physics. That's how laser swords work.
Yeah, fair.
See, also that part in the last Star Wars movie where they are dropping bombs in space and they are making noises.
Also, that is in the first 5 minutes of that movie. So sad.
Okay, oh, so I think it's definitely favorite parts time.
Yes.
Absolutely.
So I am going to steal it. My favorite part is Trace's conversation with Relina in the weird dream sequence office where he's just like, "You're free." And then he shuts the lights off on her.
Yeah, that whole sequence is so 80s Bowie. Like, it's so soft pinks and hues and Sarah.
So, anyway. So, by the way, who would bet that the first thing she does when he says you can free, he says in the subtitles, he says you're free to go any place you want. I was, as soon as he said it, I goes, oh, she's going to Hero.
Like, well, obviously. She's going to Hero. Well, she's going to go actually talk to Zex because that's what she said she was going to do.
Who's going to be trying to fight Hero? So
yes, but so Hero, he will be Hero adjacent, and she can interrupt more of Hero's reading time.
Two birds, one stone.
Kill me, Hero.
So my favorite part of this episode is something that we actually somehow didn't mention at all. And it's really just the briefest of seconds, but it was such an impactful thing for me that I rewound the episode three separate times so that I could watch it. So Sally comes, Hero's eyeing up this rocket that he's going to use to get into space. He's like, all my enemies are in space or whatever it is. And then Sally shows up with her secondhand circus mech. And straps it to the rocket, and he's like going to defend the platform or whatever while she's loading the rocket up. And there's this scene where he pivots in his mobile suit, and then the camera crash slams into his eye, into the eye of the.
Yes,
yes, I did mark that too.
I did too. It's you get really this good.
Perfectly structured robot eye that inexplicably. Perfectly mimics a human eye, even though you can tell that like there's definitely different functions going on there.
And with the camera lens, so it works like an eye. It's green for some reason. I'm sure that's fine.
Guys, it's the power of Gundanium. It doesn't matter.
It's cool.
It's fine.
What's the coolest way we can end this transition?
It was an awesome shot, eye. But I was like, oh, so the eye is like functional as an eye? Anyway. Camera. Yeah, it just seems like, wait, if we poke him in the eyes, like it's you're just waiting for a Three Stooges sketch to happen, is all I'm saying.
What I'm saying is if you poke the Gundam in the eye, it'll blank out the cockpit screen.
Yeah. I think they've done that in Gundam series before.
Hugh, I think you're right. I actually think you're totally right, because if you notice, all the Gundams enter the mobile suit through the chest, so you can technically destroy the head of a Gundam and the Gundam can still function, but I don't think it can see.
Right, because I think it's in 00 where they like have to, where they get the head gets cut off and then like we have to use the gun camera to see.
I think the only Gundam series that actually has the heads be destroyed and it ends the fight is G Gundam.
And that's because it's a rule.
Yeah, like once you destroy the head, you have to stop because you can't destroy the cockpit because they don't want anybody to actually die. So right. I think that solidifies the point that, yes, you're right. These eyeballs in these Gundams work as actual physical eyeballs, except they're made Gundanium and glass, I guess.
So I'm just saying this is going to definitely end up as a GIF. But anyway, Spence, what was your favorite moment?
My favorite moment was Choa's lack of adherence to the laws of physics. And also him saying on multiple times, "I guess I'll cover you," you know, and also making terrible decisions. He's not my favorite like Duo is, but Duo was kind of lackluster this episode.
Duo was lackluster.
They definitely Return of the Jedi like Han Solo'd him in this episode. Yeah. Like all of a sudden, the competent, suave guy turned into the bumbler. But anyway,
yeah.
What about you, Banks?
Honestly, like I was sitting here thinking about it. I was going to pick the truly erect phallus that was Zex's sword.
My God.
But I have to support the first model kit that I ever got, which is the emergence and the full act. You can actually get to see the Death Scythe in its full glory. There's only a small, like 2, maybe 3 second shot of it flying with its actual wings folded over as the cloak. Mm-hmm. And I was really happy about that because that is probably, it is my favorite Gundam model. When they give the Death Scythe the wings that fold over and become the cloak and he gets the double-bladed scythe. It is my favorite Gundam, and I love it still to this day. No matter how ridiculous any Gundam is in G-Gundam, the Death Scythe still sits at the top of my preferred list. So seeing it in its full glory flying, gotta say this is my favorite part.
Cool.
Second to the phallic sword of Zex.
Yes, yes. Okay, so that wraps up today's episode. You can find all of my stuff at hugejronald.com.
You can find my business over at skinner.fm.
You can find me at talknerdytomepodcast.com.
And you can find me at resonantmoon.com or gameschool.tsrpn.com.
You can find links to all our stuff at nostalgiapilots.com. And join us next time where we are going to be discussing Mobile Suit Gundam Wing episode 42.
The meaning of life?
Battleship Libra.
I was close.
What are you doing in the kitchen?
Writing a short story.
With a meat mallet?
Well, yeah. My characters are giving me trouble.
Well, then what about the cheese grater?
I have to make sure my plot points are evenly spread through the whole story, don't I? Oh, my action scene is done.
Wow, you got it perfectly browned.
350 degrees for 12 minutes. Perfect.
The Melting Podcast, a writing variety show featuring a little of everything, from everyone, everywhere. Short and flash fiction, author interviews, book reviews, and more. Come visit the Disaster Kitchen and cook up a story. Something's burning.
My dialogue!